This is an interview with Linda Stitt. We're at the Memorial Union on July 14th, 1992. And Linda, my name's Jan Ingram. I want to start by having you talk about your family and educational background.
Okay, Jan. I was born in Milwaukee. I'm one of nine children. I'm exactly in the middle. I have five brothers and four sisters. I have most of my family yet. My father passed away about 12 years ago. Most of my family lives in the Milwaukee area, and we remain very close. I went to Catholic grade school. I went to West Division High School in Milwaukee, and then to UW-Milwaukee, where I went up to my senior year and was student teaching and decided I couldn't stand it. And so I quit school and I moved to New York City. And I was there for 6 months, and one of the men I knew came to New York and said, "There's no reason for you to be in New York. Why don't you move to Detroit?" And so I did that. And we were married in 1969 in the student union on the Wayne State campus. And we remain, Bert and I remain married to this day. When he finished school at Wayne State, we moved back to Milwaukee so that I could finish my degree. And I stopped the education portion and received a BA with a major in Latin.
What about your career interests? You said that they started in teaching,
mm-hmm.
And they changed to Latin. What was that career motivated?
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to be a high school Latin teacher, because when I was in high school, I had the most wonderful Latin teacher, and so that's what I was going to be. And I still liked Latin, and I took Greek, and I took French and history, and I could have had probably close to three majors, but Latin was my major.
What about, what brought you to UW? When did you get here as an employee?
I started here in January of 1980. Bert accepted a position with the Department of Development, Bert is my husband, in September of 69. So we moved from Milwaukee to Madison in 1979, I mean. And then I started here in January of 1980. And when I came on camp, well, I knew I wanted to find a position. And I went to Native American Studies and introduced myself to Truman Lowe, who was director at the time, and said, "Do you know of any positions open on campus?" And he gave me a 5-month opening at Memorial Union. And so that's where I started.
And what drew you to the Indian Studies Department?
Well, I am an American Indian. I'm a member of the Stockbridge-Munsee tribe, and it sort of was my background, and I thought I wanted to at least get to know the community here, so it was a good way to do that, and Truman and I remain friends.
So that was a very natural thing for you to go to that department because of your own ethnic background.
Right, I was very comfortable in doing that. Truman was very cordial, and it all worked out very well.
Can you talk a little bit about what it was like, your position here? What sort of duties did you have as you started here?
I was a program called a program advisor for cultural affairs, which is now called Cross Cultures, and the Ideas and Issues Committee. And so the first day I sat in this office, Geraldine Ware and Phyllis Carter, two African American young women, came in because they were planning African American History Month and doing the final details for February, and it was a union program, and I was the advisor for that program. So my first day here, I met the students and began to plan African American History Month.
How has your position changed over the years? What changes have you seen?
My position has changed a lot because I'm one of the few people who is in a position that is not specifically targeted as a minority position. And I'm also one of the few people who has been able to move up a career ladder. And so I started out as a program advisor, then I was assistant director, and now I'm program director. And the union always offers flexibility so that we were able to make very compatible changes as staff changed or as program changed, and I was able to be instrumental in those changes and also move up a career ladder.
When you say you're one of the few people, you mean within the union?
Within the university. Because a lot of people of color are very specifically assigned as the MD coordinators for schools or colleges, or specifically assigned to minority-specific duties, and I am not.
And your position, you said it started as program director.
Advisor.
Advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, it changed to program
director. Director.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have there been significant events that have changed your work here? Not necessarily events having to do with diversity, but significant events that have led to other changes in your work here?
A lot of it has had to do with diversity. Some of it has had to do with personnel changes, but a lot of our program has had to do with diversity and program development. Because again, when I first started, our program was very, well, we had cultural affairs and they did African American History Month and powwows, but our music was very mainstream, our art was mainstream, and there wasn't a real nice threading of diversity throughout our program. And when I came, I had the opportunity to make those changes and begin to look at adding diversity and that thread of diversity throughout our program. And it is not limited to the ethnic minority diversity, but also includes programs for women, programs for gays and lesbians, making programs more accessible to everyone by doing signing or making sure our programs are accessible to everyone. And so we've, you know, really looked at program development in that broader scope.
So that, if you were to say, what percentage of your work at the union is related to issues of diversity, what do you think it would be?
It has to be a majority of my time, because so much of the diversity is a fabric of what I do with everything. So that if I'm doing leadership training, there's a training component on either multiculturalism or issues of diversity. If I'm hiring staff, there are interview questions or the position descriptions include something about diversity. If we're doing press releases or publicity, we're looking at making sure we are trying to target a diverse audience.
Could you talk about the value that you've gotten from the UW system's multicultural conferences?
I think the primary value has been in meeting people from throughout the system, finding out what they're doing on their campuses, and then really getting affirmation and encouragement on what we're doing on this campus. And it was a real nice networking device.
Was it unique when you first went to it, or had it happened before?
They were relatively new, and they have been, well, we haven't had one for quite a while. They used to be held at Oshkosh, so we would stay in the dormitories, which was quite unique. But they would bring in keynote speakers, and we would do workshops. And at the time, it helped sort of build the foundation of where we would all end up going with the Madison Plan and other things on campus.
There was a lot of the same kinds of procedures that had to be put in place on all the campuses? Or?
No, but the issues were similar of, you know, cross-cultural counseling or looking at different how do you change the curriculum to meet the needs of minority students, and, you know, really looking at the issues that were emerging.
So you maintain contacts with some of the people
mm-hmm.
that you've met.
Right.
You wrote a chapter that was contributed to Valuing Diversity on Campus, a Multicultural Approach. How did you come about writing that, and what did you learn from that?
That booklet was published by ACUI, which is the Association of College Unions International. And the chapter I contributed was on Native Americans. And having been involved in the association, people know me and asked that I do that chapter. And it was some background on a little bit of history, a little bit of values, and then program ideas of for college unions. So that it was both an educational tool, but also giving some program ideas in terms of if you could do a program with American Indians, what would you do? And so I set up a model for that.
Okay. So this brings to mind, makes me think, how easy has that been for you to make a transition where it almost seems like you become a spokesperson for your entire ethnic group. Am I wrong in seeing it that way?
I don't think wrong is the right word, but I couldn't, depending on who is talking to me, I can be a spokeswoman for American Indian issues. Some people think I'm a spokeswoman for people of color issues, and you always need to remind people that you're speaking from your own experience and, you know, make sure that they understand that the qualification on information.
Okay. But in this chapter, for example,
mm-hmm.
you were clearly trying
mm-hmm.
to make some sort of addressing
All right.
the whole group.
Mm-hmm. And it was like writing a paper because I needed to do the footnotes and bibliography, and so it was fun in doing, well, sometimes it was fun in doing the research and writing, because it was writing a paper.
Okay. It wasn't, I wondered if it was more experiential.
No, it was all very footnoted and not real heavy research, but definitely not just an essay by me.
Now would be a good time to talk about your involvement and your role in the multicultural education program and when you were program advisor to WUD. Could you first just describe what WUD does,
Sure.
what it is?
Mm-hmm. WUD is the Wisconsin Union Directorate. It's the Student Programming Board of the Wisconsin Union. It is composed of 14 students. They are volunteers. They have committees. We usually have 200 to 300 student volunteers on the various committees. When I started our multicultural education component, it really started when I started, because I immediately felt the need that things needed to change, that we needed a welcoming environment, that we needed education, And so we started doing a plan, and I collaborated with Karen Johnson Matthews, who's the assistant director of the Wisconsin Union and my supervisor, and I developed an outline, and in collaboration we came up with a plan that we saw as sort of threefold. How we would influence people, meaning the students and the other staff that we work with on these issues, how we would influence program and changing program content, and then the third area was resources, how we would build our resource files both for educational materials but also for program materials, so that we would be able to find films and music and art and begin to have the resources we needed to do multicultural programming.
What the year that this started then was the first year you were here?
I actually did the outline at the end of 1980, so that before my first year was over, we had an outline, sort of a plan of action with goals and a three-prong approach.
Would you describe the way this started to be used as kind of a gradual process then?
It was gradual, but it wasn't, because everyone was very open and ready to change. So I think we've caught a lot of people right when people were feeling a need for a change in a lot of different areas, where you think that hearing Polish jokes or Jewish jokes is inappropriate. When you think some of the films are getting boring, we need something different. So we really caught the staff at a time when they were changing. And we caught a lot of the students too, because we caught students who were some of the early 1980s feminists coming out of or just starting in women's studies, who were ready to embrace the notion of multiculturalism and respect for other people. And so we sort of caught people at a time and then began to thread it, because, you know, if you have it in a position description and you have it in your program guide and it's sort of everywhere, it becomes a natural part of things. And I would work with students when we tried to get rid of using the word girl, and students would actually say, please correct me if I say girl, I really want to learn how to say woman. And, how do you refer to other people? And so we really caught people right at a time when they were ready to embrace the change.
Interesting, you mentioned women's studies program, and it sounds like you see a link between that and at least some of the initial changes that happened. Was that just because there happened to be a number of people from that major in amongst the students you're working with? Or?
I don't know how it happened, but one of the committees I had was a couple of very radical feminists. I had a Palestinian, I had American Indians, Puerto Ricans, gays and lesbians, all on the same committee. And we're talking very early 1980s. And everyone wanted to work with each other and to learn, and it was quite an amazing mixture of people.
So in a way, it was a ripe time.
Yes. And I was telling someone yesterday that before the 10% Society started, that the union, the first year I was here, we did the Gay Rights of Spring in 1980. And I had to advocate for banners to be up on the buildings, because some people objected to having gay rights be on a banner in front of the buildings. Our banners were stolen, and so this was before the 10% Society, and we were doing that type of programming. And we did the first program on AIDS and HIV in 1984. from our committees. We were doing women's programs, and one of our students was the first director of the Campus Women's Center. So she went from the WUD committee to being director of the Women's Ada James Center.
Discuss your role in campus outreach, and specifically as it pertained to ethnic minorities.
Okay. One of the things we wanted to do in changing our programs was also to let the campus community know about them and know what we were doing and hopefully forward resources or requests to us. And so a part of the plan was to do a campus outreach component. And the first year I did that, I would actually go out and interview people. And I went in, talked to Truman, was my trial run, and said, well, Truman, this is Truman Lowe of Native American Studies, and said, well, Truman, I'm taking my campus outreach show on the road. Can I practice with you? And he said, yes. And so I gave him the what the union was doing and what we wanted, you know, other people, how to help us. And so he heard it. I went to Marion Lane's in housing and discussed it with her. Talked to Nancy Smith, who was then director of the McBurney Center. And then we knew that there was a committee on campus called the UW Minority Recruitment Committee. And I was eager to join that because it would also make me feel a little more at home, because you sort of miss seeing people of color, and that was a group that would meet once a month. And when I joined that group, it was very exciting because people are usually very direct in that group, and they said, well, what are you doing here? If you're with the union, you don't do recruiting. And I agreed that I did not. But that I wanted to help in the retention of students, and that we felt that through programming, we would help in issues of retention, and we wanted them to help us get more students involved and to help us change our program. I did, in fact, though, do some recruiting trips when I've been asked, and when I have time, I've gone into Milwaukee for some of the college fairs, and I've been asked by some people to go to Minneapolis, and it will depend on what my schedule is here in terms of what I can do. But the Minority Recruitment Committee meets monthly and is a group of people from all of the schools and colleges, from admissions, and some of the special programs. So it's a large group, but was a very nice way to get to meet the other staff of color.
Everyone that's on in that committee is a person of color, right?
Mostly. In the olden days, Jack Kelsvig used to chair it because he was assistant director of admissions. And then he left and Al Christ took over. And then most recently, Pete Story took over, but I think Esrald Nurse, who is now associate director, will probably take over Pete's position on the on that committee. And there are a very few schools who have non-minority staff or white staff.
When you went to that committee, you went with a specific need, and it sounds like they adapted to that, to your need, or was it a combination of yours and other requests when you wanted to get into retention?
Mm-hmm. They were receptive to it because, of course, once they would know about things, I would mail them brochures, movie brochures, theater brochures, art brochures, lecture brochures. And if you are someone who is in LNS and you can suggest to your students that they can hear James Baldwin or Vine Deloria Jr. or someone like that, That's another way to help our students on campus. And so we linked up in that sort of networking and sharing of information. And then also we were able to do special things. If they have summer programs, we would try to adapt. If people needed a special reception or had a guest coming in, we would try to collaborate and help them know how to use the union or help them with publicity or things like that.
So it was normally aimed towards students and visiting staff or faculty, or was it? I was a little confused if this was also aimed towards full-time faculty, permanent faculty.
Both. Both, because one of the things with the campus outreach on the recruitment committee is primarily staff from the different schools and colleges. But when we needed to, we would then outreach into the schools to the faculty, and then hope that both faculty and staff would help us get students and faculty and staff to our programs.
Are you familiar with how the Minority Recruitment Committee began, like its origins before you went to it?
It's always been, it's not an official type committee. I mean, it's not named or appointed. And we got into discussions years ago about, well, we are just an ad hoc committee and we just get together and we don't make decisions about anything. But we all knew that we still wanted to get together because our primary purpose was to exchange information, because the campus is so decentralized that we needed to know, and especially now, know if two people were going to the same city and sharing resources. So we shared a lot of information. And then I think everyone, like myself, had the second agenda of getting to be with people and laughing and maybe stopping for coffee or a chat after the meeting. So
you've mentioned that twice. It seems like that's something that has come up for you with this committee, that it allows you to be with people with very similar kinds of, not only the fact that they're people of color, but similar positions of stress, possibly, or...
I think more collegiality, maybe, or camaraderie, or something like that. I don't think it's stress. It's, seeing the smiling face and someone different, because it's very easy to sit in this office and get caught up here. And then when you see someone else and you sort of chit-chat, it's like a friendly environment.
Were there any points of contention in this group, or that you recall as being particularly significant, or any points of agreement that have always been there that come to mind?
Well, as I said, it's really an informational group, so you could get into points of contention. But since we are not policymakers, and since the Board of Regents sets tuition, and since the federal government will often set what financial aid requirements are, we can sort of have points of contention to say, well, with the tuition going up and the grants being cut, you know, this creates problems for our students, or how do we make things more user-friendly, and getting into some of the issues and really just raising them, but really also understanding that we're not policymakers.
As a group, have you found that you have influenced, as a group, particular policies on campus by raising issues?
Well, one of the things we've done in the last couple years is that the committee is now called Recruitment and Retention. And I can't remember if it was 2 years ago that we split into working groups and wrote some position papers that would then be used for some of the updating of the Madison Plan and in some of the recommendations that we would see for either improving. I was on the retention end of the study groups. And so we would discuss things about, should there be a reading lab on campus, since we have writing and chemistry and a lot of other things, and know that a lot of our students have reading problems. Do we need either more money or bigger spaces for math tutorial or chem tutorial? And does the multicultural center need more staff? And those sort of things where we could recommend that some of these changes be reviewed and be put into the Madison Plan as recommendations.
Did you get a sense that your voice was heard?
Well, we're at a point now where yes, because Akbar Ali, who is a special assistant to David Ward, the provost, is a co-chair of the Recruitment and Retention Council. And so he gives us, shares information with us on what is happening in minority affairs. And then we also know that he takes our concerns and issues to the provost and to the chancellor.
Could you talk about the growth of the multicultural education program at the union?
Sure. We talked a little bit before about the educational program of Wisconsin Union Directorate, and that model works so well that we began to put out our tentacles throughout the union. And again, it was something very easy to do. We talked to our people in marketing and promotion and looked at not only our media lists and diversity for targeting audiences, but to look at our images and our language and things like that. We had changed all of our position descriptions so that our personnel department knew that within all of the program staff position descriptions, one of the responsibilities is to participate in the multicultural education program in the union. And then in probably, I don't remember what year, but one year I did go to the management group and talk about what we were doing in directorate, and people understood, again, the need for it. And a lot of management had been involved in our training simply because they are a part of our training, so our students get to know some of the top-level staff. So this program was not new to them. And in the spring of 1987, when the Fiji incident started and the Steering Committee on Minority Affairs was appointed, internally we knew that we needed an action plan. So I worked with Mary Hattie DeVette in our training office using our program model and came up with a model for the organization. And then each unit had to write their own specific action plan in terms of food service. How would they change their food? And we have, in fact, a new position of a person who knows how to diversify a menu, and we have written new policies on use of kitchens, and we now have able to do feasts and special food things in our food units. So every unit had to write an action plan in response to the goals of the union. And so that was done, I think, in 1987 or 88. Every year we have to report on where we are with our goals. It has remained a primary goal for the union. And it was very, well, I used it serendipitous that when the Committee on Minority Affairs issued its final report, that probably a week later we all had a letter from Phil Certain, who was then the acting vice chancellor, wanting our action plan and any information on multicultural programs and activities that we had in the union. So we were able to respond very quickly.
Could you talk about how unique this program was at the time on campus?
Well, in my personal opinion, I think it was very unique. And at the time we started, I think it was in 1981, Paul Ginsberg, who was then Dean of Students, wanted to establish a position for a multicultural advisor. And at that time we had a discussion of should it be in the Dean of Students' office or should it be in the union. And we opted to keep our program the way it was and then to look at his office as establishing an advisor position who would have that role. And so I think that was in about 1982 that Glenda Rooney was hired as an assistant dean of students, and I worked real closely with her. And she was the advisor to the Multicultural Council, but she and I would also collaborate with training and program development. And other than the Dean of Students' office, there was very, very little done in the way of issues of diversity, other than, of course, the department-specific curriculum.
And there was, it was at this time that there was a growth into the Holly Report took place?
Mm-hmm. In 1987, the Fiji incident occurred in the spring. And in response to that, Phil Certain appointed a committee, and it was called the Steering Committee on Minority Affairs. And the students didn't like the initial committee. I don't remember who was on it, probably the same people, but they wanted to say that the people should be on it. So then Phil appointed a new committee. I was on that committee, and we met probably all of the summer of 1987. Again, we would have big committee meetings, but then we also had subcommittees. There were seven different subcommittees, and I served on the Multicultural Center Committee and the Orientation for New Students Committee. Then there were committees on recruitment and retention of students, of faculty and staff, ethnic studies, sexism and racism procedures, and community outreach. And so I was on two of the seven committees. We met, formulated a report, and it was called the Holly Report after Charles Holly, who was the student who chaired the committee. And Charles graduated, I think, that following year and entered law school here and got his law degree and is now practicing law in Chicago.
And out of this, was a direct result was a multicultural center?
Yes. One of the things that happened with the Holly Report then was, I think, Chancellor Shalala actually began her position on campus in January of 1988, and by February of 1988, the Madison Plan was released and embraced a lot of the components of the Holly Report. And one of those was the development of a multicultural center. And then she appointed a committee to look at the different approaches to a multicultural center. And I was appointed to that committee. And through that committee, it was really decided that there should be a center, that it really needed to be in the hub of campus. And the hub of campus was Memorial Union. We did go through a report that we sent to the chancellor on a multicultural center, and then she took it to implement its happening. And in order to make it happen, Union Council, which is the governing board of the Wisconsin Union, met and was asked to give up the browsing library and what was currently the travel center office for a multicultural center. And so we did that. And then the following year, what was called the Rosewood Room became the center's meeting room. And what was the travel center on the second floor went up to the fourth floor. And that space became office spaces for the five designated minority groups, student groups, to have office space.
And those are the five designated?
It's Asian American, African American, American Indian, Chicano, Chicana, and Puerto Rican.
Tell me why the multicultural center's always been called the interim multicultural center.
When I was on the first board for the center, the discussion, we needed to write bylaws and lay the groundwork for the center. And one of our charges would be to have a name for the center. And so we had discussed the possibility of a person's name, and there's a specific procedure in order to name something after a person, and we wanted to do research on that. But a number of students raised the issue that if we put a name on the center and did not call it interim, that it would be forever in a small space and it wouldn't grow. And even though some of us said, well, you know, you can move and change your address, but your name can stay the same, they would not buy that. And so we opted to name the center the Interim Multicultural Center until it will be moved someday into its own larger space and presumably at that time given a new name.
Is there a particular space that it's supposed to move to, or mm-hmm. is that designated now?
It is now. The center was included in the plan for the Red Gym. And so when I was still on the board, we needed to come up with the amount of floor space and the different things we would like the center to be. And so it's still a part of the Red Gym plan. And I think they're looking at 1997 maybe, or 98 or something like that to actually have the Red Gym project done.
The Red Gym project is approved?
Yes. It does have one phase of, well, no, it has a couple phases of approval, and they did get monies to do a study to see that the building could be modified without changing its historic status and still have safety and enough space for all of the different functions in it.
How has the Multicultural Center been received by the university community?
I think it's taken some a plan and outreach to make it accepted and to make it real alive, but I think it is alive. One of the other things that has happened to the center is we have the legacy of Charles Holley and the students who were on the Steering Committee for Minority Affairs. And every year, as new student leaders of color would emerge, they would be educated about the issues of the Madison Plan and the Holley Report. And they wanted the Multicultural Center to survive and be very alive, and so they would actually schedule hours and times and things for students to make sure that there were students always in there. And now I don't think they need to do that because students naturally go to the center, but in the first couple years, the students made a concerted effort to be there, even if they took shifts and everything to be there.
How do you see it being used most of the time?
It has multiple uses. It's just sort of a drop-in place. You can also study in there. They have quiet hours in the morning. There are programs in there so that I know American Indian Studies. Some of the other programs do brown bag lunches in there. There are the student offices, and so that has really helped build the center. We also have a computer room, and so having computers available to them is also very attractive to the students. So it's a study space, a space for students to plan activities, resource space, because you can go down and read news from Indian Country or Ebony Magazine. There are magazines and newspapers that from all the different groups. There's a meeting room to hold meetings. In the last maybe year or year and a half, some of the study programs have come in so that the academic advancement program will actually have staff down there. The dean of students and the counseling center will send staff there for hours to consult with students, writing lab. And so a lot of the student services are going to the actual center to be available to the students there as well.
So do you see any other changes besides these movements to student services coming to the multicultural center?
We do a lot of programs and a lot of cooperative things with the center. The union, we will use the center for speakers. I'm trying to think of who was here last year. But for a lot of the programs on campus, the center will be open for receptions so that you can meet speakers. And I know when Toni Morrison was here, Toni Morrison spent time in the center. Last year we had a program on the Columbus Quincentennial and had our reception, and that was truly a multicultural event in there. So that it's... We have faculty who will come in, and I think that's probably the weakest component is to really get faculty in there and, you know, spending time with students outside of doing a brown bag lecture or something.
Are there presently volunteers for the room? You said that initially
No, Candace now has paid staff so that in the evening she has a manager. Because the center is open during the union's building hours, and so that she has hired staff now, and you know, the students naturally flow in because there's also a TV set and a VCR and a boombox and
computer. Mm-hmm. Could you describe, just to go in the middle of the multicultural center in the time that it's been here, there have been some significant events. Could you describe your involvement in the Committee on Student Organizations that dealt with the ZBT auction case?
It was a terrible experience. I almost sort of block it out of my mind. Because when you're used to doing community service and campus outreach, then to get on a committee that has this very politically charged and emotional substance was very difficult. It was a committee of students, staff, and faculty. We had lawyers for ZBT coming and in with letters telling us what we could or could not do in talking to the ZBT members. We had the students of color who were very upset with us because We, of course, were to find CBT guilty, and why did we have to meet about it? I had students who wouldn't speak to me after we ended up doing our finding that we couldn't say they were guilty. And so I had students who didn't speak to me, students who didn't speak to other students on the committee. The students who were on the committee, I think, were very strong. I, in fact, helped the chair of that committee, who was Rana Mukherjee from WSA, and he had never planned meetings before. So he would come in here, and I would say, well, you need to do an agenda, and he would be like, I don't know how to do any of that stuff. And so part of it was a real learning experience for him. We had professors from the law school come and tell us what were fighting words and what could or could not be used from the videotapes. We had also had the ZBT attorney present at the same time, and so we were really in a bad spot. When we had to announce the sort of finding of, I don't think we said not guilty, but we could not bring charges against them. We had to go on the stage of the play circle as a committee and stand in front of an mostly angry audience. We left through the back entrance. There were students I know who were scuffling outside of the play circle entrance. So it's a very volatile situation, and one that I'd prefer to never see happen again.
You were appointed to the committee?
Yes.
Who did the appointing?
Mary Roustin.
And how do you remember how many members there were about? So if you could describe the members on the committee, and your own any memories you have of or opinions about what happened at that ZBT slave auction.
Okay, the committee I remember was Arlen Christensen from the law school, Elena Meyer, who was from the dean of students' office, and myself as staff. I think the other 8 or 9 members were students that were appointed by WSA, and there were students of color included among that group. It was a very emotional issue, and in looking at, I remember watching the videotape and thinking how could people be that stupid and that almost vulgar and tasteless, because we saw different parts of other skits and they were all quite inane. But among the committee members were some very strong personalities. Michelle Goodwin was on that committee also, and she would go on to become the WSA president for the following year. And so it was awful. It was really awful, and you had the law and trying to understand what justice is and how to be fair when it would be very easy to be unfair.
And from what you've said before, I get the impression that it was either very unclear what you could do as a committee, or you were limited in what you could do.
Well, see, at the time, this was before the UW-17 law of, there was nothing on campus that said you really couldn't do something specific. There was no fighting words or, no harassment rules on campus. And I think that was one of the outcomes of this, was really looking at the UW-17, which was then struck down, and we're now looking at something new. but this was before all of that, and we really did not have a fine-tuned procedure on how student organizations are disciplined. And I think part of the outgrowth of this, too, was the committee that Jim Hoyt chaired on the future of the Greek system because of some of the different abuses and behavior in the Greek system.
Was this the most blatant or largest event that you had been involved in examining as somehow, as a negative to diversity on campus?
Oh, no, I've been involved in lots of difficult situations, even the first couple years I was here, and I'm not hesitant to face difficult situations, but the emotion that was charged and continually infused, because with some of the issues that were going on, like this was in 1988, we still needed to keep the need for the Madison Plan, the need for to implement the Holley Report, the need for new initiatives, and so the papers were, the media was on it continually, and the students were very politically active. And sometimes, I think, without pondering some of the greater questions of justice and fair play sort of things.
What are the functions of the American Indian Studies program?
Well, that has really changed over the last probably 4 or 5 years. When I first came here, I met Truman Lull, who was director then, and it really played some role in recruitment and was very low profile, maybe just a sort of token department. When Truman stepped down, Francis Steindorf was appointed acting director, and that was, I think, in probably 1988, because it was the beginning of the Madison Plan, and one of the recommendations to build up the Ethnic Studies Department. And so probably around 88, I think it was, Francis Steindorf got the Indian staff and faculty together on campus, knowing that we would be recruiting a director to really set up what some of the goals that we saw for Indian Studies. And we saw them as beginning to look at developing curriculum, providing resources through a resource library or other materials we'd have, providing support for recruitment and retention efforts on campus. And I think it was probably about 3 years ago then that Gary Sandifer was named director. And he has really moved the program forward. The program was originally named Native American Studies, and that term has always been confusing for people, because anyone who has been born here considers themselves a Native American. And so the department was changed to American Indian Studies, I think around 3 years ago for clarity purposes. And we did an honor program for Gary in April to really thank him for all of the work he's done for the department or for the program. He has brought our community together. We now have maybe at least 5 affiliated faculty members since he's been here who have been hired in history, anthropology, English, education in some of the departments. So we have, and we're developing curriculums. Gary teaches a very popular course in through sociology, very active in the community. He is currently and hoping that before he steps down in August to do a certificate program for American Indian Studies and using women's studies as a model. We've done some major conferences. Probably, I think in 1989, we did a conference called Celebrating the Lives of American Indian Women and did a three-day program, invited American Indian poetry, fiction, storytellers to campus and did a major conference. And Gary helped us, you know, and American Indian Studies was the primary sponsor of that. I've been on the planning committee because Gary has considered any American Indian staff members to be staff of American Indian Studies, and as part of my campus outreach role in the union, we've been able to co-sponsor the programs with American Indian Studies and help them use our facilities and everything.
Is there a direct link between the committee and Wang Shik?
Okay. Wang Shik is the student, American Indian student organization. And they get involved in everything that American Indian Studies does. But then as a student organization, one of their primary things that they sponsor is the annual powwow that's held in the fall. And then we also, as a community, help the students do the powwow.
So your main involvement with Wang Shik is through that affiliation?
Yes, and I used to work with them when I was a program advisor. We would do before, you know, we would co-sponsor the powwow when we used to do the powwows in Great Hall. We would do American Indian film series with our film committees and get students from Wang Shik to work with Wisconsin Union Directorate students. So way back before Great Hall got too small for the powwows, we used to co-sponsor programs with Wang Shik. And then I used to go to their meetings at night to help them learn how to plan programs so that they would know sort of the, this is how you do it, you need to reserve a space, this is where you usually get money from, here's how you do publicity and do sort of that educational thing. I used to do that years ago, and now they don't need me anymore because they know how to do it. There's been a lot of good continuity there.
So what is your sense of the strength of that, of Wang Shik as a student leader?
It always has the ebb and flow, but again, probably in the last 4 years, because of the initiatives, again, of the Madison Plan and the high profile of the Multicultural Center and, you know, Wang Shik having a table downstairs as well as another office. It's, you know, the students have really pulled together.
And does it, I'm wondering how important you see these organizations to both you, the American Indian Studies Committee work, and also how important you see the Wang Shik to Native American students. What's your perception of that?
Well, I think student organizations are important since that's part of my business. and usually student organizations, and like Wang Shik, for example, provide a welcoming environment for students who are new and away from home. So you get together with a bunch of students. And we last year started a study group so that, you know, students could even study together as well as play. They then learn all of their skills in program planning. And we've had issues within the last year of students wanting their old office fixed up so that they could have a drum in there, which is what we used to do way back, 10 or 12 years ago. And so the students would actually meet with Mary Rouse and Akbar from the provost's office and Paul Barrows from the chancellor's office and actually meet with administrators and faculty and say, you know, this is what we want. You know, this is why we think we need it. And so the organization helps the students develop that as well, and as well as the friendships and getting to know what classes to take from whom and when and all of that.
Would you discuss, you discussed the Waukesha's reasons for wanting a drum in their office?
Mm-hmm. Well, a number of years ago, they would have the Madison drum would come to the Waukesha office, and it really provided an opportunity for students to hear the drum. The drum is always called sort of the heartbeat of the people, and it was also a way for students to learn the songs, to learn some of the drumming needed so that they could be ready to powwow. One of the other things that's come up in the last couple years is the Four Winds Dance Company, and that is the students getting together to learn how to dance. And for those students who are not regular powwow competitors, it provides a nice opportunity to either learn their own traditional steps better or to pick up some new dancing techniques. But the drum is always a real soothing and comforting. Makes you feel like you're at home or relaxed.
Are there any other specific needs that you see Native American students coming to campus with that are different than other people of color?
Well, part of the whole American Indian tradition is that we do come from tribes, and so that we do have tribal identity, that we have some very general values that are very important to us, like our families and the earth and the environment and things like that. But we have tribal affiliation. Some of our students come with their languages. My tribe lost their language years ago on the East Coast, but you know, there are Winnebagos in this area who still speak Winnebago. We have Navajos who still speak their language, and so sometimes a lot of the culture shock of leaving your very comforting community and coming into onto this campus can be a little bit of a culture shock. And that's why I think Waukesha is important, why American Indian Studies is important, and role models on campus for students to feel real comfortable in meeting staff. We're in the process now of interviewing for a retention specialist that will be part of the Dean of Students' office, because we found that a number of our students, especially when they come from reservations, have problems in school. And then we find that we're real surprised that they are sometimes students we know, and we don't know they're in trouble. And so we're hoping to develop mechanisms, because you don't want to be intrusive, and yet you don't, you know, you have that whole issue of sort of losing face or shaming your family, and what do you do, and, you know, so to really try to change our environment a little bit and also provide maybe some better academic counseling and advising and getting students early.
Is there anything you'd like to add, especially concerning anything you see in your future work, in any future goals or things that you're anticipating coming up in your job?
I just tell myself I need to learn how to say no, that I need to spend more time reading and doing things for myself and saying, no, I can't be on this committee. And then it's like, oh, all right, I will. And but otherwise, I just, life here on the one sense remains the same because, you know, you're going to have a semester in summer school, but it's always different, so you don't know what the issues will be, and that's sort of part of the excitement of it. So I couldn't tell you right now where we're headed other than beyond first semester, but I think that's the challenge and the excitement of it.
Okay. Anything to add?
No.
Okay. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.